back to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, with me, Tony Gosling. The Commonwealth ridiculed like never before tonight as Prince Charles and Cameron sit down to supper with the architect of Sri Lanka's genocide. Yes, Prime Minister Cameron and the King-in-Waiting, Prince Charles, from down the road in Tetbury, are sitting down to dinner tonight with a former British colony with one of the world's worst war criminals. The Sri Lankan President Rajapaksa and his evil army chief brother are running a genocidal police state. India and Canada have boycotted the talks, so why is Britain still there? We talked to a Sri Lankan-born, London-based Tamil to explain the situation, plus the strange death of GCHQ cryptographer seconded to MI6 Gareth Williams. How can the Met Police say there was no foul play? But first, I'm joined on the line by Ram Selvar. He was born over in Sri Lanka and he's now based in London. He's a Tamil. Ram, hi and welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, Tony. Hi.
First of all, can you just explain whereabouts in the world is Sri Lanka?
Sri Lanka is sort of promoted nowadays tourism, promoted as a tear-shaped island at the tip of India, basically Indian subcontinent, jacks into the Indian Ocean. It's like central position on Indian Ocean.
Now, give us a bit of background on the political situation there. I understand there's two main factions over many years have actually got along fine together. So how did the Tamils and the Sinhalese fall out?
Yeah, two nations. You can't really compare it like Scotland and England, but it is a little bit more distinct than that, you can say, you know. There are two nations and two distinct languages. There's a bit of religious allegiances also there, like Hindu and Buddhist. Tamils are more Hindu, Sinhalese are more Buddhist, but with colonialism, Christianity comes in, so there's no big religious divide. But what it has done is it has sort of unified the different nations into one administrative unit for the British rule towards the end. They inherited it from the Dutch, who inherited it from the Portuguese. The inland areas were finally dominated by the British East India trade. It was all dominated through trade, the colonialism there, by 1815. So since 1815, it's been a unitary sort of a ruled unit in the British Commonwealth. And when it was sort of given dominion status in 1948, it's widely considered as independence. The real independence was in 1972, 2 years after I was born. So I was born in Ceylon. So it was known as Ceylon, and it had a constitutional change that also took away minority rights protection that was in the 1948 dominion stateless constitution. And I heard you introduce it as architect of genocide, the current president. I would say he's the architect of a peak of the genocide. The genocide definitely started with land issues in a heavily populated island in a geostrategically important point in the center of Indian Ocean, you know.
Okay, can you just talk about the geostrategic? I mean, this is an interesting side that I hadn't actually thought of, and I've seen on none of the news coverage. What is the geostrategic importance, or obviously there are big world powers looking at putting their forces in different parts of the world. What's the importance of Sri Lanka?
Many respected geostrategists say that the next sort of power play. There was a time when the Gulf region, the Middle East, was important. For the oil supplies and stuff, just that the Indian Ocean and the rim of the Indian Ocean, now control of the Indian Ocean it's the most important power play in global dominance at the moment. It sounds a bit weird, but having come from there, I have come to appreciate that theory, which has been put forward by very respected geostrategists, let's put it that way, who the U.S. State Department follows like a Bible, you know.
For example. That sounds a bit frightening.
And it says this, like most of the trade of the oil, about 70% of world's oil goes past 30 miles south of present-day Sri Lanka. And resources, you know, a huge, more than 50% of all the world's resources goes past one way. And the other way, most of the time it comes the other way, coming from east to west, lots of produce, you know, from the plastics we see to electronics and stuff like that on the sea, like a Silk Road, it's like a sea motorway, you know.
Oh, crikey. So there's a lot of world trade coming past it. Obviously an important place to dominate if you want to try and dominate the world, as I'm afraid some people do. Now, tell us a bit about the situation back in 2008-2009, because this is when things came to a head. And also, of course, Rajapaksa was the president at that time.
Yes. A lot of clear analysis coming out, and it's very clear since about the 9/11 incident in the States, sort of the de facto state, the Tamils were fighting a sort of a genocide. They were replying back with militancy, and it was branded terrorism by the US State Department ahead of 9/11, but nobody took it seriously.
Well, I mean, I can remember news reports right the way through the late 2000s about the Tamil Tigers, this being a constant source of annoyance, it seems, to most of the Western countries, at least to the Western mainstream media. What was going on at that point? And was there any possibility of the two communities actually, you know, forming almost like two different states and organize themselves, or even possibly having changed the constitution which guaranteed minority rights?
Yeah, about year 2000, I think, after the Tigers, as they were known, this liberation forces in the north, they had the infighting bits and the faces, and they were dominated force. They were running a de facto state, and any military camps that were like pockets of resistance of the Sri Lankan state within the Tamil homeland, they overran the biggest camp in the year 2000, just before the new millennium, and they were in very much power in the year 2000, but their politics and philosophy was very unique, and you couldn't identify with anybody. That's part of the reason why I'm also here, because I never joined to fight with them, you know. I had left because I couldn't be part of the fight. They were fighting oppression, but it was very determined, very heavy, focused, and... So by year 2001, they had formed something out of what was called terrorists, but not taken so seriously in the West. But as soon as terrorism became a big buzzword, Sri Lankan government, you could say, used it, but it was their fact, the politics and the structure and the independence, this new state the Tamils were forming there, was not welcome in the new world order. So they basically, the peace was disturbed, let's put it that way. There was peace talks going on, and it was disturbed. Like, to give an example, one round of peace talks was scheduled to happen in the United States, I think, or something to do with the peace talk, but a banned terrorist group couldn't attend as an equal negotiator. It was negotiated by... Norway, and so it happened in Norway, and then in Tokyo, all the peace talks, and in Geneva. When it came to the U.S. rounds, it just couldn't happen. So that's where it started going. So it's to be looked at beyond Sri Lanka, really. How the peace got disturbed.
Okay, well, thanks for coping with the phone that's going off in the background there, Ram. Tell us a little bit about what was actually happening in 2008-2009 then. I mean, I've seen various figures for the genocide. I mean, the Channel 4 News have reported 40,000, they believe, civilians killed by the Sri Lankan government. This was where they were being herded into so-called safe areas and then shelled by the Sri Lankan military, and also, of course, once the Tamil fighters surrendered. Many of them were then, although they thought that they were going to be maybe put in jail or something, or eventually freed, many of them then were killed too. So what on earth was going on with the 40,000 civilians murdered?
It was very quickly. I have to correct a few places there.
Okay.
As I say, the genocide had a peak in 1983, race riots. You know, so there were other peaks which I suffered too. You know, I got aerially bombarded when I was living up there. But the thing is, by year 2009, the northern part was sort of planned and captured, like not the extreme northern bit. So the jungle areas just south of the extreme northern bit, let's say. Before that, the eastern part was captured. At one point, when the eastern offensive, as we can put it, by the government, 17 aid workers were executed. And nobody really looked at it. You know, French organizations, local aid workers were executed in front of the French staff there, you know. There was huge, serious human rights violations in 2007, 2006, 2007. But in 2009, from about, I would say, just in last month of 2008 till end of the war in May 17th, 18th, 2009, for about 4 or 5 months, all the people were cleared in what's now come to be known and marketed as the Sri Lanka model of counterinsurgency. How to you know get rid of anybody fighting for rights anywhere, basically, from stopping from anybody coming in with new types of political thoughts through, you know, violently put them down. So
now this sounds particularly horrific. If people around the world are trying to use the mass genocide that was conducted in 2009 in Sri Lanka as a model.
Yeah, what they did was they called it zero civilian casualty humanitarian operation, and they actually called the greatest rescue mission in the world and claimed there was like far less number than how many people were in there, which is exceeding 400,000. They probably drove fear. The fear is one of the key aspects here. You know, for many years it's been just fear has been the thing, you know, like plaguing the whole island, you know. So they just said that there are only 70,000 to 80,000 people in there and asked every witness to leave.
So to what extent were Western powers, Ram, involved in all this, or was it just simply something that the Sinhalese and President Rajapaksa was organising?
I think the Bush regime, the Blair regime, and the Indian sort of, India sort of geopolitical stance had changed, with Pakistan being a pro-Western country to becoming a prime enemy, and India being a pro-Soviet country becoming a friend. India being a big player, the regional superpower in some sense. They engineered the whole thing, basically, and there was few government changes in Sri Lanka during that time, from 2002 till end of 2005, when this sort of new president, who all the focus is on for presiding over and conducting this sort of very ruthless clearing of people. Basically, they didn't illegally imprison the whole population of an area into what they call the world's biggest refugee camps or displacement camp or internment camps. Tamil propaganda, I would say quite rightly, would call it concentration camps. That's what they were concentrated into, camps. A lot of human rights abuses went on. Soon after, when the war finished in May 2009, they just really went on trying to grab these lands that were empty of people, devoid of people, you know, and to erase any traces of the mass massacres that happened, calling it zero civilian casualties. They carried on, and the Tamil protest that sort of erupted in London spontaneously somehow got itself organized and somehow got the sympathy of few media people and documentary makers, and Channel 4 produced 3 videos. That seems to be the, everybody keeps mentioning Channel 4 as a big factor here. Channel 4 screened 3 one-hour videos, or documentaries, that sort of clearly points it out. They're called Killing Fields, Killing Fields Part 2, and No Fire Zone. The No Fire Zone literally means like everybody was asked to go into 2 or 3 different No Fire Zones by the government, where they were intentionally shelled. just to make them run helter-skelter and rip apart any resistance from the rebel forces or the other nation or however you want to say it. Just use the people running helter-skelter as a weapon of war.
Well, you know what this makes me think, Ram, is that for a government and its army to treat civilians in such a fashion, are the Tamils possibly actually freedom fighters fighting against what is actually an evil despotic regime? Because, you know, there's really no excuse to be treating civilians like that. These are international war crimes. I mean, we were hearing just now about the Bush government's involvement in this, and what are your thoughts then about what's happening with the Commonwealth heads of government? Because, you know, we've got our leaders, we've got Prince Charles there, we've got William Hague, the Foreign Secretary, and we've got David Cameron sitting down with these people. It starts to look as if that there is actually some sort of tacit support. Do you think that the government here in Britain actually does support Rajapaksa? Because what we're hearing from the government is that our government is that they're saying, oh, we're going there to try and sort of persuade them and, you know, schmooze them and say, don't be such nasty people.
I cannot say, I haven't watched mainstream news, but I understand there's an explosion of reporting on this because Prince Charles celebrated his birthday yesterday. He was cutting birthday cake with this despot who sort of everybody acknowledges it's sad to see the Queen wouldn't go. They held it till last minute to even announce that. Then Charles stood in. Then he was supposed to initiate the privatization of the education system in Sri Lanka, for which all the universities have been protesting against privatization of education and basically build some new kind of international universities. So Charles was to lay the foundation stones today, you know, for it, and everything has been cut short, and I cannot see his partner there. Camilla Parker Bowles is not there in photos. I haven't followed it. There's so much happening.
Well, I'll tell you what, something else is happening, Ram, is that a lot of Tamils have been stopped by the army and by the police who have been trying to travel to Colombo very bravely, I have to say, because many of them are under threat of being disappeared before this Commonwealth summit. Hundreds and coachloads, various people who are trying to get to Colombo to reach the ears of Cameron and Prince Charles are actually being stopped before they're even allowed to get to Colombo.
Yeah, more things have happened today. Cameron visited the north. So these people who were trying to come to the south, they live in the north, in that big city in the north called Jaffna, the biggest city, all war ravaged. But there's a public library there, the main Tamil library for Tamils, more Tamils, 70 million, 80 million Tamils live in Tamil Nadu state in India, just across 26, 28 miles of sea, at the closest point. Now, all the Tamil people's main library, Jaffna library, was burnt by the government of Sri Lanka, for which later presidents and leaders apologized. Now, that particular library was a meeting venue for Cameroon to meet the recently elected Northern Provincial Council chief minister, which was, there were elections, and there was his chief minister. So Cameroon goes to meet them. There was a sort of a, I wouldn't call it a demonstration, I would call it a demonstration to attract attention to, apart from this 40,000 figure you asked about numbers of people killed, 40 to 70,000 people killed in those 4 or 5 months in 2009, there are more people who have disappeared, who surrendered, and surrendered to the army as probably, or most, it was the UN was negotiating in the middle, they would come back, you know. So these are documented surrenders and disappeared, just picked up by the military state. Now, so people, and the Prevention of Terrorism Act under the British model, the whole military police there is British model. Nobody can ask questions, nobody can protest. So these people search forward to give a memorandum to David Cameron. How that turned out to be that, I was just reading online. The explanation is David Cameron was not supposed to come. It was debated till the last minute whether he would attend or not. So when everything was rushed through last minute, the fact he was going to go north was possibly decided within the last few days. So British High Commission had told these people that the schedule of the Prime Minister, British Prime Minister, is beyond them. So they tried to give him a memorandum or a petition of some sort. The police went very brutal. The question here is, it's been proven by a lot of people that the British police training is ongoing.
So there are British police, you say, in Sri Lanka actually training the army?
Yeah, that's also, that I see. I mean, they were active during this massacres of 2009 from Northern Ireland, from Belfast, who sort of seeded the British sort of police in Northern Ireland, RUC at that time in the 80s, seeded the Sri Lankan they're sort of in between police and army, you know.
So they're doing the training. Anyway, finally, can you tell us a bit about the disappeared? Because this, in a way, is one of the most frightening aspects of this, where people are simply just disappear off the face of the earth and are never seen again. This is echoes here of Pinochet's Chile, fascist dictatorships.
Yeah. I mean, what more can I say? We know it happens in other parts of the world, but it still happens. There's some figure, some statistics said it's the biggest number of disappeared after Iraq. I don't really get it how they measured it, but what I can understand is David Cameron was going there he was saying, I have to go to Chogham to listen to the concerns. But now when he goes there, he's now squarely accused of not listening to the concerns of the people. The people were trying in two places today to give him this memorandum, which can be just emailed over to him, I suppose, but, you know, that political act of giving it to him, just his security detail didn't want to pick it up. You know, he was obviously beyond reach of these people. And so the disappeared is just it's an ongoing thing, thanks to our sort of apathy, that we don't ask our politicians to act on this, and they just come up with anything and everything to carry on with the businesses that's going on. So go back to the Chogham, the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting, has got a business trade aspect to it. That is the key business going on.
So they're basically cutting deals in the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting. Well, look, I'm also joined by a presenter that usually isn't on until 7 o'clock. That's Cyrus the Virus. Hi, Cyrus. You're an ex-infantryman. What do you make of this, what's going on over in Sri Lanka? We've just heard from Ram there in London, one of the Tamils.
I kind of agree with Tam and that. I can understand it from all you're saying. The RUC are there, the secret services are there. Whenever there's a war, you've got to understand. To understand wars, to train for wars, you've got to go to wars. And the British have always been very good at spying. Excellent spying and gathering information for now and for a later date.
So were you actually serving over in Northern Ireland at all yourself, Cyrus?
Yes, I served in Northern Ireland.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because we're seeing what Ram is saying there is that some of the police, actually, from Northern Ireland, maybe actually overtraining people to do torture and this kind of thing in Sri Lanka.
Propaganda is 95% of all the war. I think because of the TVs, Tony, these days, people want to think that war's got rules. Like they're making noise. You know, I'm a Muslim. They're making noise about that Marine.
Well, we just heard
that killed it. Well, that's war.
Well, we heard, for example, from Ram just now about some of the horrors that were going on over there. We hear sometimes nothing. But we also heard, even though there were 40,000 or so civilians being killed over there, that there was zero civilian casualties. This is the way this is put out.
The media is such a powerful tool, isn't it? And them that have got vested interests. Who's selling the bombs? Who's selling the bullets? Who's making them? The company that owns them? The company that gets the more raw material out the ground? You'll find it's the elite. These are the ones that always benefit.
Well, they're the ones that are cutting the deals inside
this
Commonwealth Heads of Government.
Human life, again, on civilian terms, is put up there like it's valuable. On military terms, it's no more valuable than corn. They really, it's, I told you, I've been to Northern Ireland to know that you're just a number. If I got shot on Monday, I'm replaced at 2 o'clock. Simple, replace, get another one. And it's like a machine that just rolls on. And again, even in the military, it's only the officers who are worth anything.
Well, we had Elijah Smith on here, who's another former army soldier, and he was saying it's just stealing for the tribe.
Yes, but basically, yes.
Okay. Before we say goodbye to Ram, can you just tell us what would be your message tonight to David Cameron?
The fact that I sort of on a Bristol radio, it's very fitting. There's a Bristol MP, Kerry McCarthy, has been asking. I've been reading bits of answered questions recently on human rights of the Commonwealth debate initiated by her. I cannot understand from what angle it started. She was asking about trade, what type of British trade is going there. Lord Green, one of these people involved in fracking, he sort of
asked. And money laundering, by the way, HSBC when he was chairman.
He answers on behalf of BEIs. Oh, yes, the UK trade and industry. He basically made a mistake or a complete lie in Hansard, you know, but it should be taken forward diplomatically and it should be pushed forward. What's going on in Sri Lanka is the Prime Minister's trade envoy, Lord Marland, and Anglo-American's UK contact person were co-chairing the Commonwealth Business Council, which is Business Forum, which was a two-day event. It's sort of a session on natural resources. As we know, the Commonwealth is full of natural resources, Canada to Australia to all of Africa almost, you know. They're even bringing in Francophone countries into the Commonwealth now, and Mozambique is into the Commonwealth now. So what we need to do is to sort of give support to some people. Should, you know, press on whoever has supported Kerry McCarthy asking these questions. I thought was really good. I don't know how to get in touch with this person. Others should support. You know, people should get. Things are happening in the world. That's a positive way to look at it. You know,
well, it's great. Yeah, I mean, I'm actually quite proud that our local MP Kerry McCarthy has been doing this. There's a story on Reuters today, and the Huffington Post are saying that top Tory donors hit Sri Lanka for Commonwealth Business Forum. Cameron has come under fire today as it emerged that numerous Tory donors came to Sri Lanka for a business forum before the controversial Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting. Construction giant JCB, telecoms group Leica Mobile, two of the Conservatives' biggest donors, have sent delegates to the Commonwealth Business Forum, which is estimated to have had business deals worth $2 billion on the table. Kerry McCarthy, Labour MP for Bristol East, told the Corporate Watch website, David Cameron has failed to make human rights a priority in the run-up to the Commonwealth Heads of Government, both in terms of his own attendance and in terms of his apparent focus on drumming up business opportunities with little regard for human rights context in which the meeting is taking place. Rajapaksa's government human rights record has sparked international outcry, with Prime Ministers of India, Canada and Mauritius all boycotting. So I'll just let you have your say finally, Ram. I mean, what message have you got for Mr. Cameron?
Yeah, just listen to the people. I mean, what went on in this northern town today is just a great example, you know, all that what he had been saying of, I am going there to listen to concerns from the ground. You normally think people won't come forward in a country plagued with fear. People did heroically come forward, and they were not listened to, clearly, you know. So go back to the drawing tables, that and don't just run away with, now they might just even change the head of chair. It's so disgusting to have this man as the chair of the Commonwealth. He himself wanted, the President of Sri Lanka wouldn't want to be the chair of the Commonwealth. It's just difficult to be in the focus and in the limelight. So everybody will just remove him, and I think the next head of Commonwealth is going to be Mauritius, which is a banking haven, offshore banking haven. So what's going to happen is they're going to move to Mauritius 2 years ahead of time, you know, and forget about Sri Lanka, this spotlight that's shining on it right now. We shouldn't forget about it, because it's a great chance to think about all these new things that come up with Commonwealth Charter and stuff like that that were drawn up this year. That's what this human rights debate by Kerry McCarthy was probably about. I'm not sure where it comes from, which angle.
Well, I mean, it's come from the Corporate Watch website. Anyway, Ram Selvar from London, Sri Lankan-born Tamil, living in London. Thanks ever so much for joining us on Drive Time.
Thank you so much.
BCFM 93.2. Now, I'm also joined, as you just heard, by Cyrus the Virus from the Typical Tropical, Apropos Tropical show. Got you in the hot seat now, Cyrus.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about your experiences in the army. How does the what we've heard about Sri Lanka relate to, and how do you relate to that?
I always find it amazing when people are shocked at people disappearing, nasty things that go on at war. Soldiering's not like a 9-to-5 job, and when you've got to get dirty and you've got to put yourself in that mind frame, it's not nice, it's not comfortable. You're normally marching on an empty belly, lack of sleep. You've got to make microscopic quick decisions, especially if you're taking fire. You lose people, you lose friends. Revenge.
But what about the situation's a bit different in Sri Lanka, surely, because you're dealing largely, so there were some of the Tamil fighters, but the real criticism of what's been going on in Sri Lanka is the actually murdering of civilians. I mean, actually herding them into no fire areas and then lobbing artillery on top of the civilians.
And again, it's war. And who's playing by, and the thing is, Tony, who's playing by the Geneva Conventions? This is where Cameron loses his argument. All the time you've got America and England and the other Security Council that for Nathan Rothschild and his cohorts, his little world army, with Guantanamo Bay. You know, terrorism. Well, that's never going to end. You know, Geneva Convention sets down, if you take your prisoners, there has to be a time when you release them, let them go, or get rid of them. And I think that's what the Tamils leader, that's why he got so mad about Cameron trying to give a speech when the heads of states actually know what's really going on.
Well, look, let's come back to home for a minute and look at these TPIMs. These are the replacements for the control orders. I don't know what you make of those, because there's quite a lot of people, mostly Muslims, have been put under these control orders, stuck into a house, and they're not allowed to leave the house, not allowed to use a mobile phone, etc., etc. Anyway, earlier this week, there's a chap called Mohammed Ahmed Mohammed, who's being discussed rather a lot. He apparently went into a mosque and changed into a burqa and then disappeared. He's been under one of these TPIMs for a very, very long time. And earlier this week on 5 Live, Victoria Derbyshire, who does a morning programme on BBC 5 Live, spoke to Mohammed Ahmed Mohammed's lawyer, Gareth Pearce.
Committee that is investigating this, it seems, one hopes that they have further hearings in which they're given accurate information, not utterly misleading and false information. And there is much important public debate continuing on the back of this. And if enormous changes in the law are yet further recommended, it would have to be on proper information. What was said was quite wrong. Firstly, the young man in question, the breaches were being late by minutes at a police station, and for the most part in a police station in Ipswich, a town which he had no connection, where he was parachuted in on a control order, having been forcibly removed after being tortured in Somaliland. It's the most extraordinary case with the most extraordinary record of state complicity in illegality. And for it to be being presented as a young man who by choice was in this country when he lived in Somalia with his wife and child, who was prevented from returning from Somaliland where he'd been tortured and falsely arrested, to his wife and child, but instead forcibly removed to this country, on entry detained under Schedule 7, which the courts found was unlawful on his re-entry, placed under a controlled order, subjected to exile in a town he knew nobody, in a country he didn't want to be, and then to condemn him, the criminal prosecution, for being late to report to police stations when, as a torture victim, he should have been being treated and supported is a most extraordinary circumstance. And yet one hears no trace of any of that in what's being reported.
So Mr. Mohammed was living in Somaliland until, you say, he was forcibly removed here to the UK 2 years ago.
Yes.
Why would he be forcibly removed and by whom?
He was detained for a period of over a month in Somaliland, subjected to a mock execution, tortured, starved in circumstances where there is clear evidence that the British authorities had pre-knowledge and pre-planning of his seizure in Somaliland, were present and contributed to his interrogation there and torture, and were party to his removal to England. This is all documented and was disclosed in the course of the control order proceedings. This is not imaginary. This is on the record.
Before I ask you about the allegations of torture in Somaliland, why was he being detained?
He doesn't know. He never knew.
Does he know why he was brought back to the UK?
No.
He's a British citizen, though.
He's a British citizen of Somali origin, his family from Somalia, and that's where he'd been living for many years.
And what is your evidence that he was tortured with British knowledge and complicity?
The evidence came from Mr. Mohammed himself in the proceedings which were heard by the High Court in relation to the control order, and then thereafter the TPIMS, as they're called.
And what is that evidence?
His evidence was that he was seized in Somaliland, which he was visiting, and that present at the time of his seizure, when he was then hooded and shackled and subjected to, thereafter, to a mock execution, that he heard British voices, and that the questions put to him under interrogation in Somaliland emanated from Britain, were focused on Britain and people in Britain.
What is your client accused of?
I think you should ask the authorities and not us, because he's subjected to an executive order which depends upon secret evidence, not evidence that he's made party to, and is dependent on, so far as he's concerned, a generalised allegation which he always strenuously denied, that he was party to any activity that could be called terrorist in Somalia. He strenuously, vociferously denied it and demanded to know the evidence, but he was subject to proceedings in which it's all designed to be heard in secret.
So when you hear or read comments that suggest that your client has, quote, close links with Al-Shabaab, what do you say?
He denied it. He denied that throughout.
Theresa May, as you know, told MPs that Mr. Mohammed does not pose a direct threat to the public in the UK. Is that right? And does
I'm
he
sure,
pose...
I'm sure he posed no threat to the public in the UK.
Does he pose a direct threat to anybody anywhere, as far as you know?
No. Nobody who hears this, who reads it, recognises the Mr. Mohammed that they had dealings with. Nobody recognises it. It's an extravagantly exaggerated, inaccurate, misleading, and at the end of the day, dangerous picture being painted.
The alleged breaches of the TPIM and control orders are these. Accusations that he tried to access the internet without approval, had a digital storage device, met a person without the approval of the Home Office. He's alleged to have failed to report to an Ipswich police station, possessing a mobile phone he'd not been given permission to have, failed to report to Acton police station on six occasions in December 2012 alone. You say there's nothing sinister in any of that?
Do they really sound like sinister allegations, or the kind of thing that any young man might be subject to, but particularly a young man who's been wrenched from his life, his lawful life, and deposited in places in the country where he has no one and nothing to do.
Lord Justice Jones described the case against your client as overwhelming. This was the accusations of supplying Al-Shabaab with money and manpower. And Lord Justice Jones went on to say he may be more deeply involved in the terrorism-related activity of the network.
The question has been asked and not answered, never answered. Where did this information come from? And Mr. Mohammed has always said that he believes he was seized in Somaliland on the basis of malicious misinformation by probably one individual who appeared to come into a great deal of money at the time or shortly after Mr. Mohammed was seized. If you don't know the evidence and you don't know your accuser and you don't know where it's come from, which is the vice of secret hearings on which these executive orders are based, how can you ever demolish what may be entirely imaginary? How can you do it? How is a human being to deal with it?
Mr. Mohammed is suing the British government over the allegations of torture you described. What stage is that case at?
That case has already hit the rocks of the new enterprise the government is embarked upon, which is erecting secret courts to hear evidence. So you could sue the government for involvement in torture. You could win the case and never know why. You could lose the case and never know why. This is not a comfortable process that's consistent with the rule of law and the right to an open public hearing, and is much opposed by many of the best and most serious legal minds in this country.
Why do you think he will have disappeared last week after disguising himself in a burqa?
I can't speculate on that. What one does know is the despair of individuals who have been subjected to sterile, isolating regimes such as these, who in the end can bear it no longer. There's one young man, Gary Boulevent, who I know has spoken publicly in the last few days, subjected to the same regime some years ago, absconded, eventually came back, stood trial, was acquitted by the jury when he said, I breached the order because I could not bear the life, and his control order was in the end discharged by the High Court as being unjustified.
Was your client's state of mind similar to what you've just described?
Indeed, the courts have been made completely aware of how despairing and distraught he was and the reasons for it.
Well, a harrowing story there from Ahmed Mohammed's lawyer, Gareth Pearce. Cyrus, you were sort of groaning through that, and I suppose it's because, I mean, for many things, you've heard this before. We've heard a massive news story about this terrible guy that's absconded, he's on the run, he's very dangerous, and then we hear another complete side to it, where it turns out that it looks like our security services have helped kidnap him over in Somalia on false information with a bribed witness, and taken him back to put him in a place where the regime on him is so draconian, even though it doesn't look like there's any proof that he's done anything whatsoever, that he's decided that he's going to have to try and get away. I mean, personally, I don't really blame him.
Who wouldn't? You're walking along in your own country, minding your own business, and guaranteed it will be a team of at least eight people. What? Bang head. Covered, snatched, taken somewhere. You don't know what's going on. You're being interrogated, like you said, in another, probably in an, by another set of people that are not English. Certain, there's certain regimes that are very good at torture, been doing it a long time. Then you're flown over here and given some draconian measures, and you're now the new poster boy for terrorism. Do not approach him. He's a very scary person. And the thing is, I also thought about this, Tony. If they didn't show it on the news so much, you wouldn't be scared, you wouldn't be hyped up, and it's a war against Islam, and it's much bigger than what I think the general public are
well,
being
I think,
led
I think
to
people
believe
are slowly
something.
Wising up to this, aren't they?
Yes, I do.
I mean, we heard there about this whole idea of mock execution. I know that you've had some experience with that. Tell us about
that. Yeah, well, when I first joined my regiment, Ian, I'll tell you, it was a very funny because when I was in Taunton, as some junior soldiers joined up with my regiment before we passed out, and they came back off exercise, and they went with a corporal that was he was known to be a very physically hard, he could fight, and he came back with these young recruits from the regiment I was going to join, and they made a big official complaint because they said they're animals, them guys are animals, and he said, my God, I've been in the army 12 years, and he looked at me and he goes, I feel sorry for you, Cyrus. He said, you and Pete Catt have got to go to that regiment. He said, whatever you do, make sure you stay away from A Company. Tony, as God made little apples, I met Pete Catt, August the 5th, Dover Station. We made our way up to the camp. I said, Pete, I hope we don't get A Company. Anything, A Company. Went to the guard room. I went, Cyrus, which one's Cyrus, which one's Catt? Looked at me, got the usual look. Oh, this is a black one. Love. Well, you're A Company, one platoon. Oh my God. Joined there, and there was this black man at that regiment who was like a demigod, and he was in A Company, and he was meant to be R, and I thought, oh God, I'd be. Anyway, he was only there for when I joined up, he was there on a Monday and disappeared. By Wednesday night, the welcoming party, well, funny enough, Tuesday night, Pete Catt had gone missing. Couldn't see him. And then I was in bed Tuesday night. So Pete went missing Monday night. I was in bed Tuesday night, and all of a sudden I got woken up, and then I got hit over the head with a fire extinguisher, and I got hit, not tapped. I'm talking hit.
What, enough?
I'm talking hit.
Enough to knock you out.
I'm talking hit. Yeah, no, your mum and dad ain't coming to get you. I got hit. The blood spurted out. I got hit. Hessian sack over my head, tied up and bundled up quickly, professionally and properly, and thrown in a cupboard. And then I was tied up in the cupboard, and every now and again people would run in and kick 10 tons of... Anyway, Pete Catt come flying in the room, and he's gone, they're going to hurt you, Pat. They're going to hurt you, they're going to hurt you, they're going to hurt you. Anyway, I went out there to a kangaroo court, and I was whipped with the rifle slings. I got 86 lashes, and I still got the marks on me to this day. And you know, locked in an army cupboard, and they filled it full of water. That gives you a sense of drowning because you've only got a little hole, you know. And as the night got on, it gets a little bit more brutal. And it's like, well, if you survive it, you're part of the You're part of the platoon, Tony. Obviously, sometimes these things get very out of hand. So imagine now that you catch what you're told is the enemy. And you have to remember, in the military, back in the day, we was taught that civilians are the lowest common denominators. They're a little less worthy than rats. You're actually doing the world a favour if you got rid of them. Remember that mindset. See, this is the thing. You'll get a lot of soldiers on television who are TV friendly. It's the ones that ain't on television, don't want to talk to you, don't like the world, clear off, or I'll double tap you, mate. And there's a lot of men like that. And you know, and if they do, they might mutilate the body as well. It's war. It's a messy, and that's why you come back with it with issues. It, because things that go on there don't normally go on in civilized society. And this is what I would say. Maybe the politicians should have to go in the army for 3 years at least. They shouldn't all come from public schools.
What, as officers?
And I say this, Tony, and maybe if they did, all around the world just might slow down on the fighting and killing, because it seems to be working class people dying for the rich. It's a hell of a thing to be giving your life for something that you probably don't believe in.
Well, I certainly agree with you there. Let's just change tack a little bit, Cyrus, and have a look at this amazing case this week, which is the government spy, Gareth Wynne Williams, otherwise known
in
as
the
Gareth
bag.
William. 10 unanswered questions about the spy's mysterious death. This is in the Daily Mirror this week.
Well, it's not, Tony, it's not mysterious, is it? Let's be honest. Let's call it what it is. He got killed by another agency or his boyfriend, or he knew too much. He got taken out by the secret mob.
Okay. Let's just go through some of these questions which Mirror's posing. Why did MI6 fail to raise the alarm about his disappearance for more than a week? Gareth failed to turn up for work on the 16th of August. Police were not alerted by colleagues until Monday, August the 23rd. Now, if you're a spy working for MI6, I'd have thought the minute that
hours,
you suddenly disappeared...
Hours.
That you would
hours,
there,
Tony.
There should be something done.
Hours.
It wasn't by MI6.
Do they tell me? That's what they tell you.
What was Gareth doing for the intelligence services? In the 31-year-old was considered a maths genius, having gained O levels aged 10. Before graduating from university seven.
So if he was a genius,
later,
he would have
been working for GCHQ in Cheltenham since 2001, but seconded to MI6 shortly before his death. According to his family, Gareth did not enjoy London, was about to be moved back to Cheltenham when he died. So he hadn't had a very nice time at MI6. Almost certainly he was involved in some way in cryptography, which is one of these, you know, basically the idea of how to crack codes on the internet, the sort of thing that GCHQ have been doing. So he would have known quite a lot about that. Very interesting angle to it. How did his body come to be in a bad padlock from the outside? Despite asserting that Gareth died as a result of an accident, police have been unable to satisfactorily explain how he was able to lock himself inside the hold door. But one aspect of this is that even though it was his padlock, there was no DNA whatsoever from anybody on that padlock. Now, that you said right at the very start there, Cyrus, that this was some sort of a professional job. It certainly looks as if someone had come in there, killed him, and then cleaned the environment to make sure there was no forensic evidence.
And had plenty of time to do it. And then Tony, and now look at what the police said. Nothing to see here. We don't find these deaths. There's nothing to answer. Ridiculous.
Another question: why were there no fingerprints around the bath? If Gareth had got into the bag voluntarily, it begs the question: why no fingerprints in the immediate area? Clearly, the whole crime scene has been cleaned by a professional agency. What's the truth of Gareth's personal life? The spy's family and friends had known him to be a cyclist, fitness enthusiast, and quite a private man. But during the investigation, another side of Gareth's personality emerged, which shocked and surprised them. £20,000 of women's clothing and shoes were found in his flat. Now this is,
could have been put there.
This is completely out of character, according to his family.
Yeah, exactly. So could have quite easy. Let's put him there. Put him on the seedy side. Misinformation again, and here we are again. Joe Public believing these proven liars.
Well, I think,
these,
you know,
proven liars that go into coverns of a night time and do all sorts of and I'm sorry, Tony. They do all sorts of heinous things. And they expect the public, once again, to believe this nonsense. In fact, it's insulting to one's intelligence.
Well, it's also insulting to the family to put out lies to saying that he was into sadomasochism and may have been murdered by his gay lover. Why was one of Gareth's phones returned to a factory setting before he died? The coroner was particularly concerned about this piece of evidence. When police first entered Gareth's flat, two iPhones, some SIM cards and an Apple notebook were laid out neatly on the table. Why was the heating left on when the officers found Gareth's body? Contorted position of his arms and legs led them to believe that they had been chopped up. The heating was also on, which increased the speed of decomposition for investigators. Very little clue as to his true cause of death. Why was the front door locked from the outside? This is regarded as further proof that someone else was certainly present when he died. And why did the Met's counter-terrorism officers fail to tell the inquest about 9 memory sticks found at his SIS office?
Well, we saw what the police were like in front of the commission the other day on the plebe. day, and there were the commissioners. Now maybe MPs are believing what the black community's been saying forever. You can't trust the old Bill. I'm sorry. I've had nothing positive in my life, so I can only reflect on what I got. And I once believed that they was fair and equal, and as you can see, that it runs all the way down.
Well, we have had certainly a lot of serious questions this year. I mean, and last year, of course, after the Hillsborough inquiry and the Jimmy Savile affair, massive cover-ups by the police and, of course, by the BBC.
Well, to the BBC, look at the covering up. Look how much money we paid out, $34 million, isn't it, in golden handshakes they've had of licence payers' money. And like you said, they're covering up paedophiles. It seems like in the 70s it was a little sex then. Corrupt minds. And this is why, if you're talking about this spy, he would have done psychoanalyst tests to see if he had a deviant side.
The other side of all this, of course, is the oversight of the security services with Sir Malcolm Rifkind in charge. Very difficult to see it as being any kind of proper oversight. Anyway, time to sign off now, because Cyrus has got his own show coming up in a minute. The typical topical Afro-tropical. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, independent former Labour councillor for Hartcliffe, Derek Pickup. Also, former Trades Union and Socialist Coalition candidate for Bristol Mayor, Tom Baldwin. Thanks also to Ram Selva, the Tamil from London, and to Cyrus. I'm Tony Gosling on thisweek.org.uk. See you next week.
Bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, an urgent